Climate change has amplified droughts, fires, and storms the world is experiencing. It has also delivered archaeological finds. Droughts are revealing old warships from the soil and ancient markings in entire cities. And in Texas, dinosaur footprints. So, now what? How do experts best study these findings and preserve them? Let's run all this by Sarah Parkak. She's an archaeologist and Egyptologist at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, where she also directs the Laboratory of Global Exploration. And her team uses drones and satellites to look underground, which is why she's sometimes called the space archaeologist. Dr. Parkak, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we go into space, let's talk about the climate of archaeology these days. How are severe weather events, in many cases supersized by climate change, affecting your work?
So what we're seeing now across the world are archaeological sites being exposed by climate change, by drought, by low river levels. Across England, with the summer heat waves, we're seeing crop marks show up, so patterns of old Roman villas, gardens, Bronze Age ditches, and so on. And throughout Europe as well, with low river levels, especially the Tiber in Rome, we're seeing World War II sunken vessels emerging, as well as the Emperor Nero's bridge foundations from it. So we're seeing this everywhere. And it's accelerating our ability to find things, but it's also very concerning because, of course, the human impacts.
Is this something you and your colleagues were expecting to happen?
So I think our archaeologists sort of sounded the alarm a long time ago with increasing wildfires and forest fires across the world. You know that the famous archaeological site of Machu Picchu was threatened earlier this summer. We saw wildfires blazing across Greece. You have the city of Alexandria in Egypt is in and of itself, you know, a massive archaeological site, and there's now flooding every winter. So as permafrost melts, as glaciers melt, archaeological sites from many thousands of years ago, well-preserved arrows and shoes and everything you can imagine are appearing. And, you know, we have to map these sites quickly because so many sites are going to be impacted. And I think ultimately, partly to completely destroyed if we don't start documenting them now before it's too late.
And help us understand the too late.
Right. So, you know, for example, when you have permafrost melting, you know, these are objects and artifacts and sites that have been encased and frozen for sometimes thousands of years, and they start decaying. On the other hand, you know, if you have archaeological sites that are along coastlines, and say there's a tsunami event or storms can quite literally wipe the sites away. So I don't know that the world is ready for the scale of what's about to happen with all of these accelerated climate change events. And I don't want to be Debbie Downer and give us something else to worry about. But also, you know, I think on the flip side, you know, the past teaches us so much about human resilience in the face of great climate change because so many cultures faced these problems too. They faced droughts, they faced fires, they faced disease, and they adapted, they changed, in some cases for the better.
This seems quite a moment or quite a window in time. On one hand, there are all these discoveries, as you're saying, that arise from tragic situations, but there's also technology. You're known for using satellite imagery and remote sensing technologies like LIDAR to expose more than 3,000 ancient settlements, pyramids, and lost tombs. Can you help us understand the basics of how these technologies work?
Sure. So with satellites, it's known as optical remote sensing. In other words, you're seeing archaeological disturbances below the surface. And what the satellites allow you to do is look in different parts of the light spectrum. So the things like the near infrared, think of it like almost like a space-based X-ray system, which pinpoints you to whether it's the outline of an ancient city or a tomb. And then you have things like LIDAR. It's a laser-based mapping system. And of course, you can't use standard satellites to see through things like the rainforest. But what the lasers do, so that's laser information or lasers that are shot down from helicopters or airplanes, and it gives you a complete 3D point cloud model of everything that's beneath the trees, and you can use software and remove the vegetation, and you get a beautiful elevation model of everything that's there. So my colleagues have used this technology across Central America to map thousands and thousands of previously unknown Maya sites. It's been used in places like Cambodia in and around Angkor Wat. So it just depends on where you are in the world and the type of technologies that you need to apply. But, you know, we have to use these technologies really quickly to map them, to give countries an idea of the scale of human occupation. And I think what this tells us, though, as a whole, like, we were everywhere. It's a little bit hopeful in that, you know, we've always been around, or at least for 300,000 years. And as climates shift and change, so do we. As rivers shift and change, you know, we move settlements, we adapt. That's the great lesson, I think, that the past has to teach us.
I mean, with these technologies, does it give you the option to say, we found these tombs, we found these cities, but let's not dig them up yet because we need to take our time knowing that when we do excavate these things, we don't have too much time to analyze them?
Typically in the field, as archaeologists, we don't have a lot of time to excavate or map or survey. So we use this pinpointed data to help guide us so that we can excavate more strategically. But, you know, I think we're seeing more and more of a shift to non-destructive archaeology. You know, I think about miniature drones. I think about, you know, I have a science fiction chapter in my last book where I imagine what archaeology will be like in 100 years. And I imagine these sort of nano dig bots that are responsible for doing the digging and taking samples. So many of these things are happening. You know, we can now read the charred papyri from archaeological sites like Herculaneum using infrared technologies. These technologies keep advancing and allowing us to see so much that we can't because it's hidden. So I'm a big fan of non-destructive exploration.
So in some cases, is a decision made to not touch at all? We know it's there, but we don't need to go down?
Yeah, I think ultimately, you know, it depends on the archaeological or heritage body that is in charge of the site. So, for example, one of the most famous tombs in the world that's never been excavated is the great Emperor Qin at the archaeological site of Xi'an, where the Terracotta Warriors
the Qin Shi Huang. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, talking to my Chinese colleagues, they said, look, you know, because the site is so essential to the foundation of China, they feel like there aren't the tools yet that could help to explore the tomb in the most non-destructive way possible. So they're waiting. In some cases, you might not choose to excavate a site or part of a site just because it's so fragile, or maybe you only choose to excavate a part of it. You know, ethics are such an important part of what we contend with now. And of course, crucially important, you know, for so many years, archaeologists have ignored indigenous voices and concerns and perspectives. And it's our job now to listen and to not impose our ideas about sites or what should be done with them. We have to stop and listen. So things are changing. Things are changing a lot in archaeology for the better.
And finally, while we have you here, because you so give off the Indiana Jones vibe, and you did discover one of the cities mentioned in those movies, we have to request this Harrison Ford moment. That is to give us your most exciting discovery or discoveries, Dr. Jones. I mean, Dr. Parkak.
So I have a story that is kind of archaeological and kind of not. To me, the most exciting or personal discovery that I made connecting the present to the past was the moment that I realized our son had my grandmother's laugh. And when I heard him and heard it, I cried. And the idea that these moments, these memories can transcend time and space and still exist and connect us to people and places that are long gone. You know, my grandmother passed away when our son was about a year old. It was so poignant for me as an archaeologist because ultimately that's the purpose of what we're doing. You know, we're the storytellers for these cultures and these peoples. Some of them still survive today, but many of them don't. Yeah. And it's this weight, it's this responsibility that we carry, and we have to celebrate the people in the past and honor them and, you know, show people today that there's a lot worth living for and there's so much that the past has to teach us. It makes us humble and makes me very grateful to be doing what I do. Mm.
Well, preserve that laugh. That's yes. Archaeologist and Egyptologist Sarah Parkak. She teaches at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, where she is also director of the Laboratory of Global Exploration. Sarah Parkak, great pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.